you know, I had this kind of moment like Indiana Jones did in Raiders of the Lost Ark when he and Sulla figure out that Belloc he's digging in the wrong place because he only had one side of this medallion. So the measurements were off. So I'm saying that we're looking in the wrong place and the wrong time for Babel. We need to be looking in northern Mesopotamia, and we need to be looking earlier, because the linguistic dynamics of what's happening don't line up with a later date.
This week is a special week on the podcast. April 16th. Through the end of the week, we are doing Jed Week. And those of you guys who have been with us since the beginning know that Jed was one of the first scholars to come on our show and talk about something other than Bigfoot. And he's helped us connect a lot of dots over the years. And speaking of years, Jed's been stuck in a facility for the last couple of years trying to get healthy and get better and get back on his feet. And it's just been a nightmare story for him. And so we decided it's time to raise some funds and awareness to help Jed. If you love Jed and you want to help us out, we've got a couple ways to do that. You can go to his medical GoFundMe, which we're launching this week, and it's on our website, and some exclusive merch here through Blurry Creatures, and all the proceeds and funds go to Jed and help get him back on track. And we hope you guys and the Blurry community can rally around our good friend and pal on and off the show, Dr. Jed Burton, and we can support him the best we can.
Jed first came on the show, episode 11. He was actually our first real venture out of the Bigfoot space was with Dr. Jed Burton, and here we are, you know, 220 plus more episodes later. The great thing about Blurry Creatures in this crazy journey is that there's an amazing community that's really come around this show and in this space, and Jed has been a friend since the very beginning. He's a humble guy, and he's not someone who would ask for help, and so this is really us wanting to help, you know, one of the best guys in this space, and ended up in a facility that actually didn't make him better, it made him worse. And so part of our goal was to get him out of there, and that's already happened. So, you know, we've got a lofty goal of raising $35,000 for Jed. That's a number that we can quantify for physical therapy, aqua therapy. He needs a surgery, and this gets him out of that place and the funding for those procedures. So right now, as we are recording this episode, we are about $12,000 from that goal on the GoFundMe. So if you feel compelled, and if you have love for Dr. Jed Burton, any type of gift, any amount helps, and we can really, you know, wrap our arms around somebody very special to not only to Blurry Creatures but to our community. Jed has ingrained himself into the fabric of this show, and the backdrop is very pregnant with meaning. Nate, we've got as you said before, we've got shirts too. So if you'd like to donate and that's on your heart, go check how does GoFundMe. The links are on all channels, so you can find it there. If you just want to search it on GoFundMe, Dr. Jed Burton Medical Relief Fund, get over there and see what you can do for the good doctor. If you want to help by buying a shirt, we've got a couple pregnant with meaning designs we're releasing and only doing this week. It'll be a pre-sale only, and you can go get one of those. All proceeds will go to this fund to support Dr. Jed. So it is Jed Week, and you know, come on down. The tea is sweeter. The accents are slower. You know, we're gonna have some fun with one of our really good pals, who spent his life really in the archaeological and linguistic space of the Old Testament and ancient history. So we've got a fun one today on how to rethink the Genesis 11 Tower of Babel event.
All right, let's get Dr. Jed on this one. Thank you guys for supporting everyone in this space, supporting our podcast as well through the member space. So looking forward to that members episode with Jed later this week on Goliath. Let's get Jed on this one.
We'll be right back. The history of our Earth is so different from what we can imagine.
Enjoy the journey.
The Smithsonian, that if they found out about a large skeleton somewhere, was to go get it.
I'm going to assume at least one person is right, because if one person's right, it busts the paradigm.
It all goes back to the fallen cherub. And the problem with the modern day church, they have a very truncated view of the supernatural.
This backdrop is just pregnant with all kinds of meaning associated with this Mount Hermon event.
And this guy defects from the kingdom. That's a big deal.
But and then we launch into the giant discussion. But this week's called Jed Week because we're helping Jed. We've got a whole campaign going to help Jed get rehabilitated and get back on his feet. And he's been going through some medical stuff over the years. Those have been paying attention. And we decided to kind of circle the wagons around Jed here in the Blurry community. And we have a GoFundMe that we launched. And we also have some exclusive merch. And all the proceeds are going to go to help Jed get back on track. It's been a long process for him trying to recover. Those in the Blurry member space know that, you know, it's been a long road for Judd. So welcome back to the podcast, Dr. Judd Burton. Thank you for taking a chance on Blurry Creatures and being here.
And I might add something, Nate, before you pop in.
Okay.
Judd, you were, if we say Bigfoot was the gateway drug, you were the gateway drug in the Giants. If we go all the way back, you were episode 11 for everybody who's been here since the beginning.
Yeah.
Which would have been 10/12/2020. We did our first episode outside the Bigfoot space on Ancient Giants with the good doctor who's here with us. So, Jed, you are near and dear to our hearts. You took a chance on us before we had a website, before we had anything, any really thing going on except just two guys talking about Bigfoot and wanting to get into the biblical paradigm surrounding that. So we're grateful for your friendship. And again, as Nate said, this is Judd Week. So what we've done is we put together a campaign to really come along as a community, come alongside Judd. There are a couple exclusive t-shirt designs. We're doing a pre-sale this week, so go check those out. Of course, with Judd's his legendary and iconic pregnant with meaning statement, which everyone loves in this space. Of course, part of our intro, you just heard him say it if you tune in this episode. So Judd, we're grateful for what you're doing. Go check out the GoFundMe. You know, we're just trying to be generous and help someone who's very much ingrained himself and endeared himself to this wonderful community that has surrounded Nate and I in Blurry Creatures. And Judd, you're very much a part of that. So we're grateful to have you here. We're going to blow it out all week. If you feel so inclined, go check out what we're doing with merch and go check out the GoFundMe page. You know, we're trying to get Judd to a fairly lofty goal, but we want to really come alongside him and help him get back to the vigor and health that he enjoyed before he had this medical incident that he's been really privately battling for the most part over the last 2 years. So, Dr. Judd Burton, we've got a fun one today. We're excited to have you back in our space.
Well, it's good to be back, and I just want to start off by saying thank you to everybody in the Blurryverse and you guys for, you know, welcoming me in. You know, 2020, it just rolled right past us, and here we are in 2024. Yeah, it's I'm so humbled by all of the support and prayer and donations and all of the just love that everybody's expressed and shot my way. It's really overwhelming, and thanks to, you know, the Blurryverse and people like my friend Dan Blinko and you guys, there were, you know, my basically for this next phase of what I need to do, the expenses are covered. And it's just been a real blessing. God just stepped in and did what he does. And I'm so overwhelmed and humbled and grateful to everyone. God bless every one of you. And happy to be here on Blurry Creatures as always.
I love it. That was a Tiny Tim quote there. And Judd, you don't like to talk about the little people. You like to talk about the big guys. And we're going back to the Tower of Babel today. Sometimes, you know, we've learned a few things over these last 4 years. Not a lot, but we've learned a few things. And we're going back to the Tower of Babel. And you kind of teased us with an episode about this, that there's some things there that maybe we can rethink our understanding of when and where. Judd, how do you want to kick this one off? The floor is yours.
Well, most people students of the Bible or otherwise, because it's become such a part of our cultural vernacular, most people will recognize the story of the Tower of Babel that's referenced in Genesis chapter 11, right on the heels of the Table of Nations in Genesis chapter 10 and the telling of the emergence of Nimrod and his kingdom in Shinar. And traditionally, Babel has been associated with Babylon and Middle Mesopotamia, Lower Mesopotamia. And that's understandable because the Hebrew designation for that part of the world at the time, Shinar, encompassed that area, but it wasn't confined to that area. And the event itself has been dated to a period after the advent of writing, so in the historical period, so as early as the fourth millennium BC. But over the last few years, as I've become, I wouldn't say more interested in linguistics, probably the right word is reinvested in linguistics, I began to rethink the entire Babel event in terms of where it happened, what it was, and when it happened. I think that there are some key elements to the discussion that have been left out because things like historical linguistics have not been brought into the discussion. And as we get into it today, I'll talk a little bit more about that. But a lot of it, the sort of, I suppose, scholarly ruminations that I've been involved in rethinking Babel have me looking more northwards in northern Shinar rather than middle and southern Mesopotamia. So it's really interesting to look at the history of scholarship, biblical scholarship that's been done on the Tower of Babel and the Babel event itself. And it's very convenient. I get it. It's very convenient to locate Babel in Lower Mesopotamia, Middle Mesopotamia. Like I said, it's convenient to locate it there. There have been any number of scholars like David Roll who have located it in Lower Mesopotamia in Eridu. But again, taking all of this other data into account, the historical linguistics, particularly as pertains to something called the Proto-Indo-European language shift, I think that the magnitude of that event lines up better with the confusion of languages that's referenced in Genesis chapter 11. And people are probably wondering, well, what is the Proto-Indo-European language shift? What is Proto-Indo-European?
I was about to ask that, Chad. I was like, what do all those terms mean? And what is that?
Proto-Indo-European was a real language. We had to kind of reverse engineer it from European and Asian languages. But it did exist as a spoken language. And for all intents and purposes, Proto-Indo-European is the mother tongue of the lion's share of languages in Europe and Asia. And from everything that we can tell, the Proto-Indo-European heartland was the region it encompassed the region between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea and went all the way down into eastern Turkey.
Okay.
And it was spoken anywhere between 9,000 and 6,000 BC. This, of course, putting it in to my mind, puts it in a post-flood context, especially if we're looking at the Younger Dryas event as the Noahic flood, which I think that it was. At any rate, this mother tongue gives us the backdrop for the magnitude of this confusion of languages with the actual shift and the movement of peoples away from this region.
Judd, let me ask something about that real quick.
Yeah.
This is going to be a comparison, but when we talked to Hugh Ross, Nate, about the reason that evolution, you know, you could blow that out of the water because you had these advent of fully formed organisms, not this evolution at these different periods where they just appeared.
Mm-hmm.
Are we kind of talking about the same thing where instead of having an evolution of language, you have this language just appears, is it well, like fully formed? Am I understanding that correctly?
Yeah, it is. It is fully formed. That's not to say that there weren't
like precursors or.
Yeah, there are some theoretical precursors, but the existence of Proto-Indo-European as a functional language is not really debated at this stage in the game in terms of of the historical linguistics community. But to me, what's interesting about it, why it's so important, why it lines up with the Babel event, is because there are lots of things in place in the later period. If people wanting to date the Babel event to the later period, let's say the middle of the fourth millennium BC.
Yeah.
But what you don't have is this, is the magnitude of languages and dispersal of people. You don't have all those things in place in Mesopotamia. There were only a handful of languages. And of course, the top one, the Sumerian Akkadian language in terms of the literary tradition of Mesopotamia, that was the overarching one. And you don't have that change in the wake of a proposed fourth millennium Babel event. By contrast, what you do have in the Proto-Indo-European language shift, which happens somewhere between 6000 and 4000 BC, what you do have there is the birth of literally hundreds of language families and thousands of languages that crop out of that, not to mention the multitude of ethnogenesis, or the creation of different societies springing out of this people, because the Genesis 11 also talks about the dispersal of peoples from this area. So that is firmly in place in Eastern Turkey, the Transcaucasus. So to my mind, we need to be looking more northward, northern Mesopotamia, Eastern Turkey, in other words, and earlier for the Babel event itself. Because, as I say, you've got lots of things in place for a potential Babel in lower Mesopotamia, but you don't have the magnitude of language shift, language creation, and the ethnogenesis that you have in the wake of the Proto-Indo-European shift.
That's fascinating, Jed, because I love how you look at these things, right? It's not really your, quote, conventional archaeology, right? And I know you've done a ton of that type of work in your career, field work on the ground, archaeology, but it's an interesting way to sort of change the way you look at an event, right? Because if you look at it instead of from sort of the monolith of tradition, right? This is where it's traditionally believed to have happened. You read Genesis 11 and it's 8 verses. This whole part is 8 verses, and it talks about the plain of Shinar and people move eastward, which really just, we're looking at our English versions here. We're talking about, you know, people came from the east, and there's this place in Shinar, really just Babylonia, which is very general. Mm-hmm. And this is not necessarily like an X on the map. And then to look at it from this is what you do, right? You know, from a linguistic standpoint. And we did a really cool episode with you on the origin of Raphaim and the word Rapha, right? You have this very interesting scholarly academic look at history via language. You know, not stunning at all is that this entire Babel event, aside from the practicalities of what happened, really lands on a linguistic ending. You have this scattering of folks all over the earth after God says, let us go down and confuse their language so they cannot understand each other. And so you would, and as you're saying, which I think just sort of reiterating, it's a fascinating way to look at it, because you should see, and then you look at the story and do see an explosion of language types. And that should happen. If we're to believe the biblical narrative and look at what happens in Genesis 11, then we should be able to look into the language, linguistic record, and see, you know, a corresponding explosion of language, and then take that, right? And then you can do geo and chronological sort of locating based upon where these events would have appeared to happen. And so I love this. It's, you know, in the Blurryverse, it's just, I think, one of the things we love to do, and we've, since the beginning with episode 11 with you, and you know, is to look at things in a different light in some ways, and kind of expand your paradigm to hold and consider that maybe things are a bit different than we assume, right? And so, yeah, I just wanted to sort of read, I think it's just a fascinating juxtaposition of looking at an event we're all familiar with and saying, well, what if this is, and laying out evidence for that. And I think, you know, what better place and better person to talk to about the aspect of language when it comes to Babel than you? I'll let you continue, but so you were saying that a lot of this Proto-Indo-European, if I said that right, explosion was more Eastern Turkey than Southern Mesopotamia.
Mm-hmm. And when you're saying Southern Mesopotamia, are you talking about sort of the Fertile Crescent, the closer to the Persian Gulf?
Yes.
Okay.
Traditional Mesopotamia from the northern limits of Mesopotamia would have gone into Eastern Turkey, but it would have gone all the way down to the Persian Gulf.
You think there's a connection there between Eden and the Tower of Babel?
Well, insofar as that This takes me back to the work that Dr. Aaron Judkins and I have done at Göbekli Tepe, and that we've posited that Göbekli Tepe and other sites like at Karan Tepe, Novali Chari, the contiguous level at Chanlurfa, they're all, particularly Göbekli Tepe, were watcher outposts. The proximity to Eden, both the country and the Garden of Eden, which was this strange place where heaven and earth touched, right? You know, I read in Genesis, oh, yeah, and Adam and Eve are having, you know, direct conversations with God. So our theory was that the watchers knew enough in general terms of where Eden was, and they hoped to weaponize it to try and attack heaven, basically. They either thought that they could
yeah,
defeat or win over the angel that guarded Eden to gain access to it. And so we look at it as a Babel style event in the pre-flood world. And so the same stratagem, in other words, the same mechanism is at work in the Babel event.
So you think that Turkey, I mean, if you look at it on a map, I mean, it looks mountainous, right? So, you know, these four ancient rivers that have supposedly flowed out of it. I mean, all rivers start in the mountain, they start in the mountains and flow out. Mm-hmm. Is this a dumb thought to think that Eden could be in Turkey?
No, not at all. I think Eden was in Turkey. I think that the geographical markers for it are, you know, we know two of them for sure, the Tigris and the Euphrates rivers. There's some debate as to what ancient rivers or riverbeds would have been, a Gion and a Pishon. But yeah, keep in mind too that Moses, who's writing all this stuff down, is receiving a vision of the very beginning in the same way that John the Revelator in the New Testament is receiving a vision of the end. And so they're trying to make sense of all this bizarre, you know, very different stuff from what they're used to with the cultural language of their day. You know, keep in mind that Moses was raised in the Egyptian court. He was educated. He would have had a more comprehensive knowledge of, you know, geographical markers, you know, in the ancient Near East. And so I think taking that into account, the best case scenario is for the location of Eden is still in Turkey, in the mountainous high range country of Turkey. And people that will locate it, you know, in the Persian Gulf, you know, there are people that will locate it in Israel. There's some people that try and locate it in Jerusalem. But I think when you look at the circumstances of the author, Moses's life and his education and whatnot, you know, there's pretty specific geographical parameters to what he's describing. So I think that Turkey remains the best case scenario for the location of Eden.
Well, we talked a lot about mountains on our podcast, specifically why the ancients had an obsession with mountains, you know, and then we talked about how in the ancient world they were considered the abode of the gods, right? And I think this idea, like Luke and I have discovered so many times, like, where does this idea start from? And you talked about like the names for kings. Where do we get these names? There's an origin point for how we name these god kings on earth. And I would say that the mountains is specifically an important part. I mean, Tim Mackey came on and said that he thought Eden was on a mountain because there was evidence of like rivers flowing from it,
sure,
you know, and then it gets challenged and people often debate these little things, but I think it's important to think that, okay, if we have this obsession with mountains, where does that start? And I think that starts from the beginning, that there was this mountain where, like you said, heaven and earth collided. Mm-hmm. And I think if we think about how rivers start in the mountains and they flow down, and the Tower of Babel is sort of a metaphor of this. This is what they're trying to recreate here on Earth.
Yeah,
I was going to say, Nate, it's a ziggurat, right? You have it's an effigy to a mountain, the same way the pyramids are effigies to mountains.
Exactly. Yeah, that's something we talked about before on the show, is that the pyramids, ziggurats, all of those kinds of structures are mountain effigies. They mimic the supernatural idiom that the peoples had concerning, you know, their gods, that they believed that mountains, yeah, they were earthbound, but they were these things that jutted up into the heavens, and this place where the sacred and the mundane, you know, connected, and the gods lived there. And that's why you have these little temple and shrine structures at a lot of the tops of pyramids and ziggurats. Yeah. But this all goes back to, I think just like everything the demonic does, they take what's holy and they make a counterfeit out of it, right? So Eden is in this high country and God is there, then they're going to try and make some counterfeit of that. And that's really what you have at Mount Hermon with the Genesis 6 event. In fact, I've come to believe and continue to contend that these monuments like ziggurats and pyramids and what have you, these temples all harken back to that event. They're a legacy of that. But a high place, whether it's an earthen structure or a mountain itself or a hill or a temple, the creation of this ritual space, whether it's a structure or a mountain, is what's important here. And definitely you've got ritual taking place in the Babel event, because it's not just the construction of the tower or the, you know, it's not just a feat of engineering that's taking place here. It's ritual. And the purpose of it is to assault heaven,
basically. Yeah.
And these ziggurats are different than pyramids, right? The ziggurats were like stepped. Mm-hmm. They have shelves on them.
Well, yes, that's true.
They look more like mountains.
Yes.
They didn't look perfectly triangular.
They didn't. And in fact, I mean, if we are talking about a kind of ziggurat structure, typically we think of the Sumerians as being the first ziggurat builders, but they weren't. There were some actual culture, proto-civilization that existed in Mesopotamia before the Sumerians, called the Ubaid culture. And the Ubaids go back at least as far as about 7500 BC. So like a lot of the cities that people typically think of as Sumerian, like Uruk and Eridu and Pur, a lot of these places were established by the Ubaids, and they were the oldest, of course they're in pieces, but the oldest ziggurats at those sites were all built by the Ubaid. Mm. So if we are talking about a ziggurat structure, again, because the Ubaid culture stretched all the way into eastern Turkey, it's very likely that we are looking at some kind of ziggurat structure. But again, that's a secondary consideration, because what's happening here is not so much a feat of engineering as it is a kind of magical working, a ritual.
So we are postulating about the location of Eden perhaps being somewhere in the mountainous region of Turkey, which would be northern Mesopotamia and northern Babylon at the time of Nimrod. But if we go pre-flood, which we talked about, you were talking about Göbekli Tepe and Kahara Tepe and a number of other ancient, very ancient antediluvian archaeological discoveries right now that have thrown a monkey wrench, if you will, into the archaeological timeline.
Mm-hmm.
So we know those are there. We've talked about those potentially being temples of the Watchers, because what you have there is this explosion of technology, architecture, temple, advanced temple structure, carvings, etc., that shouldn't be there in a time where traditional archaeology would tell you this is hunter-gatherer times. And we've talked about these on the show with Nate, with like Hugh Newman, for example, who leads tours there. He was big on this space. But
mm-hmm.
We're talking to you about this, Jed. So if we're going to hypothesize that those temples of the Watchers, those Watcher outposts, as you call them, they were looking for Eden, and we know that per the garden that Eden, once Adam and Eve were ejected from Eden, that there was an angel placed at the gate to the garden of the flaming sword. Can you talk a little bit about the idea of Eden being sort of a country as opposed to just the garden being a portion of Eden? Because I think that's a really interesting idea, one. And two, it kind of makes Babel being this location also make a lot more sense, right? Mm-hmm. If this was what was happening pre-flood, they were sort of looking for access points. And we know that, as Nate was talking about before, we know that Eden, the garden itself, was a place where God walked with Adam and Eve. This is Genesis 1, 2,
yeah.
3, right? God's walking with Adam and Eve. And then if you think about, and this is kind of, and I'm sort of just pushing it, but if you think about the idea that a ziggurat is to bring a god down to meet with you, to essentially walk, if you will, with God. What do you think? Can you talk about what you think is happening here? Sort of in an historical timeline, if we would believe Eden's there and the Watchers were doing stuff there. We know that, like, you know, 2% maybe of Göbekli Tepe's even been excavated. These are massive advanced structures that shouldn't exist in that timeline.
Mm-hmm.
But then we, of course, Genesis 11 have, if we're to take the, as you say, the linguistic record and place Babel there north, then how should we think about this, and what may be happening there in addition to just sort of the traditional thought around a ziggurat in the Tower of Babel?
Yeah, well, ancient Turkey, Anatolia, is usually kind of a peripheral subject in most discussions about the Bible, but it's really central, especially, I mean, if you're starting at the beginning you know, with the garden, with the region of Eden, the country of Eden. That's in Turkey. Noah's Ark comes to rest in the mountains of Ararat in eastern Turkey. That's where the sort of repeopling of the earth, you know, begins to take place. And Abraham is from Ur, which traditionally people had located again in southern Mesopotamia, but Ur was in Haran. Biblical Abrahamic Ur was in a place called Haran, which is in southern Turkey and northern Syria.
That's near Göbekli Tepe.
Yes, right? In fact, Şanlıurfa, which is probably one of the better candidates for Abraham's Ur, it actually preserves the name, is only about 10 miles away from Göbekli Tepe. The other candidate is Urkesh, which is in the same region, was a Hurrian site, and it's in that border area in northern Syria that would have been part of Haran. So, and if you fast forward to the New Testament, there's a lot going on there too. Paul is from Asia Minor, which is what they called Turkey at the time. There's a lot of mission work taking place. A lot of the major churches, the seven churches of Revelation are in there. John lived in Ephesus for a while and ends up on Patmos. So a lot of the Bible flows from ancient Turkey.
Yeah.
And I mean, it in a lot of ways, it sort of begins and ends there. The ethnogenesis, if you will, of the Hebrew people begins there with Abraham. So when you take all of these things in sum, it's hard to get past the importance of Turkey in the biblical narrative. And it also helps to make a better case for a more northerly location of the Babel event because of the location of where the ark ends up, where Noah's descendants begin to proliferate.
Yeah. So I just want to, maybe we can get a visual for people who are listening. Mm-hmm. So the mountains of Turkey, you have Göbekli Tepe there, and it kind of comes down, and you have the Tigris and the Euphrates flowing down towards lower Mesopotamia into the Persian Gulf, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the traditional people say the Tower of Babel was kind of located where the Tigris kind of, in lower Mesopotamia, where they almost touch, right? And the tower was like somewhere in the middle there. That's in Babylon right there. But that's like a more of a marshland or more lush, you know, like I said, the Fertile Crescent or whatever. So that's sort of the tradition. That's what everyone sort of says. That's where the Tower of Babel is. And you're saying it's maybe up more in the mountains north.
Yes. And right? A lot of that has to do with the Proto-Indo-European language shift that takes place between 6000 and 4000 BC. So I would situate in terms of chronology, that's the window that I think we should be looking at for the Babel event. And also because you don't have anything on the magnitude of what happens in the Proto-Indo-European heartland. You don't have anything linguistically happening like that in the fourth millennium BC in middle and lower Mesopotamia. It's just not happening. I mean, no scholar is going to debate that. What you do have in the earlier period that seems to line up better with the confusion of languages and the scattering of peoples is this Proto-Indo-European language shift that births most of the major language families and languages of Europe and Asia. That, to me, makes more, it lines up better with the biblical description. And that's what I've tried to do, you know, over almost 15, 16 years now, applying anthropological models to biblical studies. So I think that when we do that, when we try and find this middle ground between what we can glean from the text of the Bible and then what we can take from linguistics or archaeology or ethnography or even physical anthropology to help fill in the gaps, because the farther back we go, we have fewer and fewer written records. So if we're at a, you know, ostensibly, if we're looking at the Babel event, you know, between 6000 and 4000 BC, you know, any touches, any traces of a written language are minuscule and sparse at best. So, you know, I had this kind of moment like Indiana Jones did in Raiders of the Lost Ark when he and Sulla figure out that Belloc he's digging in the wrong place because he only had one side of this medallion. So the measurements were off. So I'm saying that we're looking in the wrong place and the wrong time for Babel. We need to be looking in northern Mesopotamia and we need to be looking earlier because the linguistic dynamics of what's happening don't line up with a later date.
So let's look at this pre-flood, post-flood.
Okay.
I'm more of a visual person, so my mind is trying to put like some visual context to this. So pre-flood in Turkey, you have these watcher outposts that are maybe near or trying to find Eden,
mm-hmm.
correct?
Mm-hmm.
Around, and that's the land of Shinar. Is that what you're saying?
It is. It's northern Shinar, yes.
Okay. And I mean, in Genesis 11 says that's where they settled, right? Mm-hmm. Post-flood. And then Göbekli Tepe and some of these, which is, you know, what we've talked about, some of the oldest archaeological finds, and we talked to Hugh Newman about that. They're buried, or they're obviously the flood, they would have been buried then too, however you decide that. And then Noah's Ark settles there, and we sort of get the birth of civilization again in these mountains, in this region, post-flood,
mm-hmm.
right? It could be near Eden itself. And one thing we've talked about a lot on this show is that everything is intentional. Locations are intentional. That most scholars who kind of plug in this blurry knowledge understand that, like, if Jesus goes to Mount Hermon and does his transfiguration, mm-hmm. that mountain specifically has a greater importance to the story than just some any old mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're trying to build this ziggurat, and they're trying to sort of give a giant salute FU to God, they would probably build it near Eden, I would guess, right? They would try to, mm-hmm, and they mm-hmm. wouldn't just randomly build it somewhere else.
Yeah, well, for all,
I don't know, that's just...
Yeah, for all intents and purposes, it's right next door to Eden. And again, you know, just given the importance of ancient Anatolia, ancient Turkey, the people that God ends up using, you know, especially early on, yeah, it's an affront to God. You know, whatever the structure is, whether it's a ziggurat or some sort of earthen structure, it seems to be that it probably was a kind of ziggurat or proto-ziggurat, because they're making brick to build this thing. So, but yeah, you're exactly right, Nate. It is. It's a complete thumbing of the nose to God, in the same way. Again, this shouldn't surprise us. In the same way that the demonic realm takes everything, makes a mockery of it, makes a counterfeit, takes everything that's holy and makes a counterfeit or a mockery of it.
Jed, do you think that they're looking for a portal? You think that's part of what's happening here? Like, if you're close enough to the access point, to the portal, if you will, I don't know how else to really put it, that's sort of blurry language, I guess, but like, they're looking for to be close to this space where they can get in and they can, you know, kind of backdoor themselves into a war with God.
Yes, I think that's well said. A kinetic war, indeed. There's working an intention here. And yes, I think that they are trying to weaponize this access point. I think that's what happened in the pre-flood world with the establishment of sites like Göbekli Tepe and Karahan Tepe. But I think whether they're trying to gain that specific portal or recreate that access to heaven to launch their mm-hmm. their war, yeah, I think you're looking at the same kind of modality here. And it all has to do with the creation of ritual space or the weaponization of sacred space in the case of Eden here. So I think what it boils down to is a weaponization of that access point. Yeah.
I was thinking about Eden and, you know, supposedly a cherub mm-hmm. guarded it with a sword, right?
Mm-hmm.
If it was in a flat land, like a flat marshy kind of garden,
mm-hmm.
hard to guard that area. And I think I'm starting to like the idea that it's on a mountain, because you could have it sort of backed into a certain area where you only have one access point to get to it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of surrounded by mountains. And then you have this cherub in one spot kind of protecting people from getting back there.
Mm-hmm.
If you have more of just like a practical view of Eden, I get it, that there could be some sort of gate. And maybe that's why they're building the tower at a certain height, because whatever they do, they can open these doorways from our realm to the heavenly realms, mm-hmm. but it would make sense that it was probably enclosed in some space by nature, and there was only one way in and one way out.
Mm-hmm.
And why that's such a big theme throughout the Old Testament, New Testament, you know, mm-hmm. like it that's the origin. It's all there, and it begins in the mountains. It begins on this thin space, you know, and we are constantly trying to rip off the ideas of heaven. Build things that maybe we get the idea of what kind of buildings are in heaven, and we rip that off and we build it down here, you know, because they're building certain structures all over the world. They have this knowledge of the architecture. They know where do they get that from? You know, that why do they just know how to build this stuff in certain ways? There's just these repeating themes on the show, and I'm trying to visualize maybe that's what Eden looked like.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, the words like paradise and even Eden itself is probably from a Sumerian Akkadian word, which means an enclosed garden. So they're there was only one access point at the end, you know, as you pointed out, guarded by the cherub. But here's something that might blow your mind too. There's actually a province to this day that exists in Turkey in this general location that is called Shinar.
Interesting.
Really?
It's spelt out as C, the English transliteration would be C-I-N-A-R, I think, but there's a mark under the C in Turkish that would make it sound Shinar.
Yeah.
And that's how you pronounce it in Turkish, is Shinar. So the name in that region is actually preserved. So there are all these little clues that linguistics can bring to the table that I think make a northern location and an earlier dating for Babel a more sensible approach and conclusion.
Well, where do you get all the material to build such a structure too? You need a lot of material if this thing was as big as they say it was. Is there any archaeological evidence in Turkey that this thing was there that you've uncovered?
Well, I mean, the precedents for that sort of building exist in the Neolithic period, which is what I'm proposing here, is that this is a mid to late Neolithic timing, since the Proto-Indo-European language shift takes place between 6000 and 4000 BC. So the technology, the actual, you know, boots on the ground engineering technology to build structures like that existed. As I pointed out, the Ubaid were already building structures at that time. So yeah, there's plenty of archaeological evidence to support that such a structure could have been built in that location.
Mm.
I think it's interesting too, Jed, that like if you look at Genesis 11:3, you know, we talk a lot on the show about megaliths and these stone structures that are antediluvian and have survived the flood, and then even ones that are post-flood that are super ancient and they remain because they're stone. But you have in verse Genesis 11:3, it says they said to each other, "Come, let us make bricks and bake them thoroughly." They used brick instead of stone and tar for mortar.
Mm-hmm.
So when we talk about archaeology for, you know, a Tower of Babel, it's interesting that they're using a medium that is much less durable over the eons than some of what we find, you know, done in stone, right? You know, Nate and I went to Peru. These megaliths, super ancient, more than likely, antediluvian. And you look at some of the things like the pyramids that are made out of cut stone, and the longevity of those things. So it's very interesting to me that like this is it's also sort of this innovation or change in construction or architecture at this point, because they're, instead of, you know, a massive, maybe it's just practicality too, making a massive stone tower that reaches to the heavens, frankly, is probably an impossible effort based on physics. But interesting to me, though, right? Because you have this, then you really just have a pile of bricks, and we know bricks, you know, even in a couple hundred years in our era, can end up and turn into dust if they're damaged. And anyway, I find that fascinating.
The brick stuff kind of looks a lot more like Göbekli Tepe. Why can't that be the site of the Tower of Babel? Like,
well, because Göbekli Tepe is not brick, it's stone. You're dealing with cut
all of it,
cut stone.
Yeah, there's standing stones and T stones.
Yeah,
there are, but I mean, is it all built that way? Can't remember
what the lion's share of it has to be, because what is preserved, even in the enclosures, you know, you look at the enclosures that were, you know, that were backfilled and filled in. The pillars, the enclosures themselves, all of that was constructed of limestone for the most part. You don't have much in the way of brickwork, but with the Ubaid culture and there's another culture called the Halaf culture, which was contiguous with it. And there was a lot of diffusion between the Halaf and Ubaid culture. You do have evidence of brick making. But the antediluvian stuff, the pre-flood stuff, like Göbekli Tepe, Karan Tepe, this is it's all solid stone construction.
Judd, I love what we're doing here. We're rethinking, you know, the geolocation and also its cosmic implications, which we've talked about on the show quite a bit, Nate. Like, you know, you said, like, the idea of Mount Hermon things that happen there, geographically important, cosmically important. And then again, the location of this tower, right? Geographically important for its cosmic implications, if we are to have this nearer to these ancient locations, and nearer to the places that the ancients believed Eden existed. You know, it's funny to me, and we've talked about this before, Judd, sort of off the record, but you know, Genesis 6 and Genesis 11 are really interesting because they are, as I said earlier, it's four verses in Gen 6 and, you know, eight verses in Genesis 11. So there's this implied cultural knowledge of these things. It's just sort of like Moses is saying, yeah, you know about this. This is what happened. And you kind of know about what happened here. You know these stories, right? And a bit of that's lost to us. And, you know, for Gen 6, we have, you know, First Enoch, which we talked about ad nauseum on the show. And the great thing about First Enoch is that because of the discovery at Qumran, we really have a provenance to this, just predating the time of Christ at the very least, right? Mm-hmm. So an ancient book that talks about especially the first part of First Enoch, talking about really an expose on Genesis 6. What I want to ask you as we rethink Babel and the tower, there is an account in Jasher, which is, of course, another extra biblical book. It's mentioned in the Bible. It's mentioned in Joshua. In fact, Joshua 9 and 10 was what I read in my Bible study this morning, and it references the book of Jasher. There's a lot of controversy around this book, but there are about three chapters in the copy of Jasher we have now that really deal with Nimrod and the tower. So from a scholarly standpoint, from a biblical standpoint, and you being your wheelhouse, what do we think about, how are we to think about the book of Jasher as it relates to this story, into Genesis 11 event, if you will, because there's a lot of things about garments and sort of this expose, almost three chapters that kind of revolve around Nimrod and the tower event, mm-hmm. but not quite the same provenance by any means that we have with First Enoch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, Jasher is certainly relevant, and it's interesting. Part of the concern that a lot of scholars have is this the Jasher that we have now, is it the one that's referenced in the Old Testament?
Right.
And I think substantial portions of it probably are, but we can't be 100% sure. The flip side of that is that this is what we have. And I remember one of my mentors and one of my professors said that the best we could do as historians is to make probability statements. And that means that we work with the best evidence at hand. We work with what we got. And if it proves to be right over time, then it will be corroborated. If not, it will be amended and, you know, discarded if need be. Right now, we have this document, which may shed some light on the story of Nimrod. It's really interesting because you pointed out that, you know, it talks about the garments of Adam and Eve that were actually handed down. Apparently these were tokens of authority for the antediluvian patriarchs. And there's an interesting story also in the extra biblical material about, not to veer too far off topic, I made a video about this a number of years ago, proposing that one of the stories about Nimrod and his material is that Esau, the brother of Jacob, was the one that finally killed him.
Yeah, that's part of this tradition.
Took these garments, these tokens of patriarchs. You know, again, everybody knows the story about Jacob and Esau, about how Esau came in and he was clearly, you know, discombobulated about something and so overwrought that he traded his birthright for a bowl of soup. And that sounds really odd, but I think there's a good case to be made for the birthright that's sold being this marker, these garments of the antediluvian patriarchs. Now, again, that's so much scholarly conjecture on my part, but it does add a layer of logic, or at least an expanded and fuller understanding of what's going on in the story of Jacob and Esau. But yeah, you're right. There is an interesting commentary on Nimrod in that may prove to be more relevant to the story of Babel as time goes on. I don't think we can completely peripheralize works like Jasher and Jubilees and the Genesis Apocryphon and Enoch, which is probably the one that's got the most traction. Not that we equate them with canon, but they come out of the same worldview. So they give commentary on the biblical narrative.
it feels like a lot of access to the implicit knowledge that would have been, you know, culturally ingrained for these peoples, right? It's kind of just the Mike Heiser paradigm, right? That to read the Bible is to read it as ancient Semitic peoples, right? You know, in writing to an audience of ancient Semitic peoples. I wanted to ask your thought on that because Jasher isn't the same, obviously in the same boat, right? We don't have, provenance like you do with art, where you can reach all the way back and say, hey, we've got these copies from, you know, a couple thousand years ago. It's more contemporary. But at the same time, there's, you know, we know it's mentioned in Joshua. So there was an ancient copy of Jasher. Are those two one and the same? As you said, perhaps some of it. But I find that the conversation around it fascinating because all it does for me is sort of open the story a little more to make a little more sense of at least the way that the ancients thought about that portion of the story. So if you're going to put a bow on this, Judd, summarize a little bit of your thought, because I think the best way to do this would be to go back and just say, this is why you think it's here, mm-hmm. and this is the linguistic, and this is why it's important, so that we can kind of sum up this for folks, because this episode is rethinking Babel. Mm-hmm. So if you're to summarize sort of your thoughts on this, if you've gone through this thought process and, you know, from a scholarly standpoint, sum it up for us.
Certainly. What I'm doing here, I'm not disputing any of what's going on in Genesis 11. I'm taking that as a historical event. You know, as a person of faith, as a Christian, as a believer, I accept that. What I'm saying is that the traditional location for Babel is off because it doesn't make sense in terms of the confusion of languages and the scattering of peoples. Mm-hmm. That to me seems like a very that's a significant event, because if people were speaking the same language, mm-hmm. the peoples that lived in the world at the time speaking mutually intelligible dialects of the same language, and then all of a sudden you have this massive, you know, confusion of languages.
Yeah, they would spread out from somewhere.
Yeah, you don't have that kind of linguistic event taking place in the fourth millennium or third millennium BC in middle and lower Mesopotamia. You have to look to northern Mesopotamia. You have to look earlier. You have to look. I think there's a very good case to be made for the Proto-Indo-European language shift, which birthed all of these language families in Europe and Asia, and these thousands upon thousands of languages, and the ethnogenesis, the creation of these, you know, new societies as people were scattered onto the earth. That's the kind of event that lines up more logically with Babel. And as I pointed out, the Neolithic technology is there to build that structure. We have precedents for pre-Sumerian cultures, you know, building those kinds of rudimentary structures, at least. We need to be looking in Eastern Turkey. We need to be looking in this window of 6,000 to 4,000 BC when the Proto-Indo-European language shift takes place. That's when and where, in my opinion, where we're going to find the historical framework, the linguistic framework for the Babel event. And it's still in Shinar. It's still in that northern section of Nimrod's kingdom.
Yeah. Or it says that the plains of Shinar.
Or they said it, or plain. It just says the plain. It's pretty not.
Well, and there are, in these mountainous regions in Turkey, there are plateaus. So again, there are geographical markers, geographical features that also line up with the region. There are lots and lots of reasons to be looking earlier and more northward for the Babel event. With all respect to the scholars that have located it in lower middle Mesopotamia at a later date, I understand that. It's a lot of it makes sense, but what you don't have is the magnitude of the language change. There's nothing in lower Mesopotamia in the fourth millennium BC to even approach what's happening linguistically with the Proto-Indo-European language shift more northerly.
Yeah, dude. I mean, only you could, Jed, could use language as sort of like archaeological evidence and
fish it out. Yeah,
because people like us, just regulars, you know, we don't see what you guys see. You scholars can unpack and say, look, there had to have been a structure here because of all the linguistic evidence that kind of flows from that spot. I never even thought about it like that. I mean, we did that the God Kings episode. Mm-hmm. You can go back and listen to that one, listeners, if you want to like kind of get a even a more in-depth dive of the names of kings themselves and kind of the origins of that. But Jed, thank you for coming on again on Blurry Creatures and dropping this. And for everyone else, just a reminder, we have Jed Week kicking off. If you're late, if you're listening to this 3 or 4 weeks late, the GoFundMe, you can find it. We'll put it on our website. There will be a flyer on the front page of our website for a while. And go help Jed out. And the pre-order for his merch will be a week long. So if you want to get a shirt Pregnant With Meaning, we got two designs. And it's Jed, I think it's rather appropriate. Pregnant With Meaning with the Paramount logo. Talking about mountains.
Love it.
And then we got an old 80s AC/DC one, Pregnant With Meaning. Go support our good pal, Dr. Jed Burton. Jed, thanks for coming back on our show, and we wish you the best. And
you know, Jed, we love you, man. We can't say that enough. And this community loves you and really believe in they're going to rally around you and help get you back. We can't wait to have you. You're back to full engines, full power. And it's been quite a journey. We always say enjoy the journey, right? Episode 11 to episode 232. It's been a journey with you, my friend, and we love it. But yeah, 1.21 Jedawatts.
Was just about to say that.
We're getting
that. You took the words right out of the
mouth. Yeah. Back to the Burton.
I love you, bro.
No, I love you guys too, and thanks to everybody. Yeah. I mean, God bless each and every one of you, and I will keep you posted and updated on what's going on.
That's good, brother.
All right, guys.
We'll be here
thanks,
for it.
Thanks, Jed.
Love you, dude.
Next time.
Love you too.
Be well.
Roll that time cop, Jed.